have a discussion about these management plans that guide the protection of these special areas across the state.
Environmental groups praise a new direction in the state's approach to land management. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska's new Attorney General talks about the National Guard issue.
I think for the healing process to occur, there needs to be a public vetting of what happened.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
When Governor Bill Walker took office, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game was in the midst of overhauling its habitat policies. Management plans for 3 million acres of fish, bird, bear, and moose habitat were being rewritten in a way that could allow more development. Division Director Randy Bates described the approach in a 2013 interview with APRN.
The idea is, can we get to yes instead of can we justify no?
Now, Bates has been removed from his position, and the new administration wants to re-evaluate the state's approach to land management. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The Habitat Division was all set to release its first batch of revisions in December. They were overhauling plans for the McNeil River Refuge, a popular grizzly viewing destination, and for Potter Marsh in Anchorage, and the Mendenhall Wetlands in Juneau. But when Republican Sean Parnell lost his re-election bid for governor, all of that was put on hold. The new Fish and Game Commissioner, Sam Cotton, says there were concerns that the management overhaul would reduce the level of public involvement. He says he wants Alaskans to have a greater role in land management decisions.
It appears that wasn't the practice in the instance we're talking about.
Because of that, Habitat Director Randy Bates has stepped down from his position. Governor Bill Walker accepted his resignation on Monday and is currently considering candidates for the vacancy. Bates began changing his division's approach to management plans in 2013. Before that, those plans involved a multi-phase review process that had stakeholders working through the rules with state biologists. The new approach would limit the opportunities for public involvement to one comment period, with plans released in a batch instead of individually. Only one, a plan for the Dude Creek Critical Habitat Area in Gustavus, has been edited in the new style, and the draft removed the mission of cooperating with the community and considering cumulative impacts of different types of human activity. Sections prohibiting oil and gas extraction and mining were also rewritten so permits could be issued for those activities. According to an internal email leaked to APRN in 2013, habitat biologists were prohibited from discussing changes with the public without prior approval. Bates did not respond to emails to his personal and work accounts for this story. But previously, he has said the changes were necessary to simplify the habitat rules and to give Fish and Game more flexibility with the management of sensitive lands. But Bob Shabelson, the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, says they watered down existing rules.
Well, streamlining is kind of a code for substantive rollbacks. It sounds good. It's all about efficiencies and making things more predictable. But in 100% of the cases that we see the term streamlining, it's really about rolling back substantive protections. And what that meant in this case was cutting Alaskans out of their rightful role in shaping these policies for our critical habitat areas across the state.
Shavelson was part of a campaign to stop the revisions of the management plans. This fall, nearly 1,000 people signed a petition supporting the effort. Shavelson says the removal of leadership is a sign their message is getting through.
This should be a public process. it shouldn't be happening behind closed doors. We want to have a discussion about these management plans that, guide the protection of these special areas across the state.
Bates is the second Fish and Game director to be removed since Walker took office. His resignation is one of a number of personnel changes that signal a shift from the Parnell administration's approach to land management. In December, the governor accepted the resignation of Doug Vincent Lang, who directed the Division of Wildlife Conservation. Vincent Lang was also involved with the special areas revisions and has attracted complaints from conservationists who most recently opposed his decision to terminate a monitoring program at the Round Island Walrus Sanctuary. That same week, Walker also installed Sam Cotton, a former Democratic legislator, as his interim Fish and Game Commissioner. Cotton has openly criticized one of the Parnell administration's major priorities, a permitting bill known as House Bill 77 that failed after conservation, fishing, and native groups fought against it. Last year, Cotton cut an ad attacking former Natural Resources Commissioner and now Senator Dan Sullivan for promoting that bill. Cotton says that when it comes to land management and permitting, the Walker administration does not plan to follow his predecessor's lead.
I think that we'll see a different approach there.
He expects a replacement for Bates will be named later this week. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The incoming Alaska Senate president has decided against hiring a former state military affairs official to help the Senate Majority Press Office this session. Senator Kevin Meyer last week told colleagues he had decided to hire McHugh Pierre on contract to work in the press shop, but a contract had not yet been signed. Pierre last year was asked to resign his job as a deputy commissioner in the State Department of Military and Veterans Affairs as part of a leadership change following a scathing report on problems within the Alaska National Guard. Pierre has said he did nothing wrong. Meyer says Pierre could have become a distraction for the caucus. Despite the fierce fights waged in Congress over the Affordable Care Act, a bill to loosen the employer mandate sailed through the U.S. House last week. The vote was unanimous for what's called the Hire More Heroes Act. The aim is to encourage small businesses to employ veterans. The bill says veterans wouldn't count toward the 50-employee threshold that determines whether a business is required to offer health insurance. Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of the co-sponsors of the Senate version of the bill.
When they get out of the military, they're looking for employment. We want there to be no barriers.
The bill would apply to employers who hire anyone with health care covered by the VA or TRICARE, the military insurance program, so it appears to include active duty family members, too. In Alaska, 1 in 10 residents is a veteran, according to the VA. Murkowski says the bill wouldn't diminish the health care law.
If your federal government is caring for your health care needs in one area, do we need to do kind of a double dip, if you will, by requiring the employer to also provide for that level of care? So I don't think that it undercuts the Affordable Care Act in any way.
This year, for the first time, businesses with 100 or more full-time employees are required to offer health insurance or pay a penalty. The threshold drops to 50 employees next year. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the Hire More Heroes bill would cost the government some $86 million in lost penalty revenues each year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Elam woman celebrates a century of life.
Go knock on the door and she used to say, go get my Honda, let's go pick berries. Yeah, when she was 93 years old.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board meeting is Wednesday, January 21st through Friday, January 23rd, 2015 at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. The meeting is open to the public either in person or by teleconference. Public comments and input on the proposed changes to federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations is being sought, along with specific fisheries proposals. Meeting materials found at regulations.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Alaska's new attorney general is a 39-year-old who has spent the last 10 years practicing law with Governor Bill Walker. Craig Richards grew up in Fairbanks. He's enthusiastic about his new position. Richards says the Department of Law is dealing with two big challenges right now. The first is the National Guard issue.
And in particular, making sure that state government did the right thing and also ensuring that it is on track to change, if necessary, to do the right thing and treat service members appropriately on a go-forward basis. This second is frankly the same that all government agencies are facing, which is a very, very difficult budget environment. A significant amount of my time has been spent learning the Department of Law budget and really taking, you know, a cold, hard look at where reductions can occur and what cases really don't need to be filed and, you know, what we can do to reduce the cost of operations.
You're expected to recommend a special investigator to Governor Walker in the next few weeks to look into allegations of sexual misconduct and cover-ups in the Alaska National Guard. Why is a special investigator needed?
So I think that there's two functions that the special investigator brings that is useful over using internal resources, which was an option, and it was one considered and one that was not dismissed lightly. And that would just essentially being having a, you know, a prosecutor probably within the special prosecutor unit look at the issues. And the two things that I think a special investigator brings are, one, it brings independence, a fresh eye, and with independence you also, if there was any institutional problems in law enforcement, Department of Law, otherwise, I'm not suggesting there are, but you'll have a cold look at it from an unbiased person. And second, I think that the people of Alaska and the men and women of the National Guard, I think for the healing process to occur, there needs to be a public vetting of what happened. And that's not a traditional role of a prosecutor or even a criminal investigator. So part of the scope of the work we're looking at is to have a report prepared that the public can read and see and really understand what happened. So in that light, I thought a special investigator made sense.
You've spent a lot of your career fighting against the oil companies on behalf of municipalities. Do you think that will help or hurt your job as Attorney General?
Well, I don't know that fighting is the word I would use. I would say I was a lawyer litigating zealously for my client, which is my ethical obligation and what makes me an attorney. But I think having an experience in complex litigation is helpful. Some attorney generals in the past have had that, some haven't. But to run a large legal group, I think it is immensely valuable to really have, you know, gone through the mud, the blood, and the tears in the trenches of litigation. It's an important skill to understand, and it's an important skill to really be able to analyze and look at cases and see likelihood of success and when it makes sense to go forward.
Rural law enforcement is always a big challenge in Alaska. Tribal sovereignty is, of course, has to be part of that conversation. The Parnell administration spent time waging a number of legal battles against tribal sovereignty. Do you think that there is a different approach perhaps that will be taken, or how do you see that going forward? And is there a way in which perhaps tribes with federal government assistance as far as funding may be able to take on more of those rural law enforcement duties?
Well, one thing about the tribal issues that I'm certainly becoming very aware of is that it's really multifaceted, and there are a lot of different facets to the jewel. So it's not as simple as, do you like tribes or don't you like tribes? Do you recognize sovereignty or do you don't? The state of Alaska's policy position has been since the Millennial Agreement in 2001 under Governor Knowles that tribal sovereignty exists, that tribes are governments, and that the state of Alaska will communicate with tribes on a government-to-government basis. So the Parnell administration, for instance, didn't change that policy and recognize the sovereignty that the federal government has granted those tribes. Certainly, the Walker administration will be on track to do the same. So in terms of local law enforcement, which is what we were talking about, you know, I don't see a cookie-cutter solution. Everyone would love to find one, but these are very small communities. Funding is very difficult. So it's really going to be, I think, about working with tribes to define what works for them with the resources they have and what they want to take on. I think you'll see some communities that want to have an active tribal system that provides real alternatives for nonviolent offenders, for local guidance, basically, in terms an alternative to the state system. I think you'll have a lot of local communities and tribes that don't because they don't have the resources or the desire to effectively have that mechanism embedded. So I think the goal is to work with the different communities and see what makes sense in light of available funding.
There's been reports from the Rural Law Enforcement, Rural Justice Commission that suggested an idea such as perhaps creating some sort of a quasi-border around communities and allowing tribal governments to have a certain level of legal authority within that area so that people, both tribal members and non-tribal members, would be subjected to local law enforcement. Any thoughts about some sort of a system like that?
The answer is I have thoughts, but it's just that, and it's very formative, and I don't want to get out in front of myself. I mean, the issue about the extent to which tribes have jurisdiction over non-members is contentious and developing. It's not a well-developed body of law, either in Alaska or outside. So that particular issue, I think, is one that's it's a learning process for everybody. You know, you've really seen it in the child enforcement cases and in the protective order cases. But in terms of drawing a boundary, I mean, that's one alternative. I've also heard the alternative suggested of developing regional hubs and having tribes come together and develop more of a regional model. So I think we're going to look at all those, but it's a little premature to sort of get out in front of anyone.
Craig Richards is Alaska's attorney general. He needs to be confirmed by a majority of the legislature. He says he hasn't yet made a decision on whether to drop the state's appeal of the court decision overturning Alaska's ban on same-sex marriage. Most placer mining operations in Alaska are small, but combined, they bring in about $100 million per year, KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
In 2013 alone, the report finds placer mining, or the mining of stream beds, was active in nearly 300 operations around the state, about 30% of which are in Nome. And while it's difficult to describe the typical placer mine operation, many have elements in common. Alicia Amberg is the deputy director of the Alaska Miners Association.
Most of our placer mining operations in the state mine for gold, and they're in remote locations, the majority of them are. And our average amount of employees on the placer operations in the state are around 4.
The new study was commissioned by the AMA from research firm the McDowell Group and combines a statewide survey of miners with data from the Department of Natural Resources to shed light on just how big of an economic engine placer mine operations truly are.
You know, our placer mining truly is the 7th large mine in the state of Alaska.
The report finds placer mines directly employ up to 1,200 workers. Most are seasonal jobs, and more than 70% of workers are Alaska residents. And the report says placer operations pay well, too, with more than $65 million in goods and services spent keeping the operations going, of which nearly 90% is spent in-state. Barb Nichols with the Nome Chamber of Commerce says that's consistent with what she sees on the ground in Nome during the busy summer mining season.
The economic impact of mining to our Nome economy is certainly positive. Jobs have been created for many local residents. Multiple local businesses that provide goods and services have reported increased sales and income during these months. Even the businesses that offer the daily needs, such as our grocery stores and restaurants, have stated increased sales.
That's partially borne out by the city of Nome's own figures, which shows a peak in collected sales tax during the summer, and those numbers have generally peaked higher every summer for the last 5 years. Deantha Crockett, the executive director at AMA, says even as placer mines disappear elsewhere in the country, the report shows there's still viable mining operations in Alaska.
There are far fewer placer miners today in the United States than there were 3 or 4 decades ago, and frankly, 99% of them are in Alaska.
The state of Alaska also makes money off of active placer mines through royalties, taxes, claim rentals, and other fees. But the AMA says, quote, confidentiality issues and other data restrictions kept an exact dollar estimate of that state revenue out of the report. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2015 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
The U.S. Forest Service is holding a public meeting in Juneau tonight to discuss a proposed fee increase at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, starting with the 2016 tourist season. Not only is the agency looking to raise the fee for the visitor center itself, but for the first time, it wants to charge people for the use of some nearby trails. Visitor Center Director John Neary says it would be the first cost increase at the facility since 1999 and would help offset federal budget cuts.
What Congress allocates us is in rapid decline. My budget, the congressionally allocated portion, has dropped 50% in just the last couple of years, not to mention previous drops.
Under the proposal, the visitor center entry fee would go from $3 to $5, and a new $5 fee would be charged to use the Photo Point Trail, the Steep Creek Trail, and the viewing pavilion, bus shelter, and restrooms. Other areas near the Mendenhall Glacier would continue to be free. After a strange freeze-up and a few winter thaws, the Kuskokwim 300 will follow the Kuskokwim River exclusively from Bethel to Aniak and back on the same trail. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
Race manager Zach Fensler says the giant ice jam below Kalskag near Coffee's Bend has been cleared.
They went through with an ATV and with a snow machine to kind of test depths. Then they used preliminarily a dozer from Upper Kalskag, went through and kind of cleared an initial path, and they used a truck plow, I think, to go from Kalskag to Aniak to clear the initial paths. Then they followed that with some heavy-duty graders that were, I think, from the traditional village in the Paiute that went through.
The ice jam formed on the river in November. It consists of about 4 miles of sheets and boulders of ice 3 to 5 feet tall. The Kuskokwim 300 is an approximately 300-mile sled dog race that usually includes some trails off the river, but with almost no snow on the ground and icy conditions, organizers decided to stick to the river. Clearing a trail through the ice jumble was made possible through joint funding and manpower from 9 organizations and tribes in the area. Mark Leary of Napaimit was part of the crew.
It's still, you know, bumpy and windy. We're going to keep working on improving it. The weather will help. You know, if it snows, it'll get better. If it rains, it'll get better. And then people driving over it more and more, it'll get better.
Before they cleared a path through the ice jam, Leary says it was nearly impossible to get through it.
Well, it was hard and slow. There was no danger. There's always some risk involved when you're working on the ice. But, you know, everybody that was involved is experienced. We were just glad when we were through it. We were glad everybody shook hands and we talked about how to keep working on it to make it better and safer for everybody.
Leary says this is the third time a jam like this formed in his lifetime and the first time so many village organizations have gotten involved. The Kuskokwim 300 race is scheduled to start Friday, January 16th at 6:30 p.m. 31 mushers are signed up. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Last week, more than 100 people gathered in Elam, a small community of about 330 people on the Seward Peninsula, to be part of a milestone for Elder Eliza Katungan, a celebration of a century of life. KNOM's Kristen Leffler was there.
If you've ever wondered what it feels like to turn 100 years old, Elam's Eliza Katungan can tell you.
Good!
On Thursday, January 8th, friends and family traveled from all over, including Shaktulik, Unalakleet, Koyuk, and Montana, to celebrate Eliza's 100th birthday. Eliza's niece, Grace Morris, came in on snow machine.
I just arrived from Koyuk. She's a real blessing to me and my family, and I praise God that she lived 100 years old. I love you, Auntie.
Pink and purple streamers hung in the Elam School Gymnasium as over 100 people were welcomed for the birthday celebration and potluck.
Because there's a lot of native food. I think the plan was most to have native food than anything.
As Darlene Ketchatag was helping to prepare the food before the dinner began, she shared her own story about Eliza.
And me and my twin sisters, Doreen, were adopted from Nome. And when before we came to Elam, when we were very little, Eliza took care of us for 2 weeks before we were three months old. And so I adore her. She just called me her baby. Aww. My baby.
And in her 100 years, Eliza has touched countless lives. Born in 1915 at the original site of Shaktulik, Eliza later settled in Elam, where she has lived most of her life. She had 14 children and has many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and even great-great-grandchildren. Known as a loving caretaker and a fountain of cultural and subsistence knowledge, family members and friends were eager to share stories of how Eliza has impacted their lives.
My name is Michelle Sikuth. I'm the great-granddaughter of Eliza Katungan. When she was 93 years old, she used to come get me. She'd go knock on the door and she used to say, "Go get my Honda, let's go pick berries, or let's go pick greens." Yeah, when she was 93 years old.
Kenny Sikuth, a relative of Eliza, spoke of her love and knack for fishing.
We bring her fishing a lot every spring. She'll sit there for hours till she's done, and we can't go till she's done.
Paul Nakuruk, a resident of Elam, has known Eliza his whole life.
I have some things that she made over the years, even a pair of dog mittens. She's a real active lady.
Relative Betsy Baxter learned how to sew, knit, and crochet from Eliza, among many other important things.
And most of all, the love that she showed me while I was growing up here in Elam. That's the most memorable time growing up with her.
The birthday celebration lasted about 5 hours with live performances of some of Eliza's favorite songs and, of course, a joyful rendition of Eliza's 100th happy birthday. Reporting in Elam with Courtney Cousins, I'm Kristen Loeffler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith and Kristen Loeffler in Nome, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Enroll now in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the Health Insurance Marketplace. Visit GetCoveredAlaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by ASHNA, a partner of Get Covered Alaska. The Federal Subsistence Board meeting is Wednesday, January 21st through Friday, January 23rd, 2015 at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. The meeting is open to the public either in person or by teleconference. Public comments and input on the proposed changes to federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations is being sought, along with specific fisheries proposals. Meeting materials found at regulations.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.